You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the head of a conservative Wisconsin law firm reacts to the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the state's attorney general filing a lawsuit that challenges Wisconsin's 1849 law banning almost all abortions. Now, the state Supreme Court ruled this week that Fred Prehn can keep his seat on the policy-setting body for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Prehn was appointed by former Governor Scott Walker. His six-year term expired last year. This week's court decision was in response to a legal challenge from Attorney General Josh Call. So why is Prehn still on the board? Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob.
So I walked through a bit of the story in the intro. Can you flesh it out a little more for us? So why is Prehn still on the board leading up to this lawsuit?
Well, Prehn has argued for more than a year now that there's a prior Supreme Court ruling. It's, I forget the name of it. It's often referred to as the Thompson decision, but it was a ruling in 1964 that basically allows holdovers in office to continue serving on the board until the Republican-controlled Senate would confirm his successor. So basically, conservative justices have said that they just don't see any reason to depart from that decision, that pre-existing ruling, and they think it remains, quote, as sound today as it did when the case was first decided.
And then in the background to the story, Governor Evers has a nominee for this position, this post. What's happening there?
Yeah, so Sandy Noss is a conservationist from Ashland, or rather she taught at Ashland High School, and I think now she's in Drummond teaching. And she has more than three decades of conservation experience. I believe she led the Bayfield County Conservation Congress, and she's just got a really good record of qualifications in natural resources and conservation. And so Evers appointed her to the position on April 30th of last year, I believe. And since that time, you know, as we've said, Prehn has refused to step down, and he's essentially blocked her from taking a seat on the board. But also, you know, the Republican-controlled Senate has refused to act to confirm her.
And what did Attorney General Call argue in bringing this lawsuit?
So he basically argued that, you know, because Dr. Fred Prehn's term expired, that he was no longer protected and could be removed for any reason, not just for cause, because basically what the Supreme Court cited and this prior Supreme Court ruling had said is that you can only be removed from a position if you die, you resign, or for cause, or basically like misconduct in office. And so he's been sitting there ever since.
Talk to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, looking at the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board. The state Supreme Court ruled a holdover appointment could stay on that board while a nominee of Governor Evers has not been confirmed by the Republican-led Senate. Danny, let's talk about the Natural Resources Board. Why would we care who is on it? What do they do?
Yeah, well, it's the policymaking board for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So they decide a lot of contentious environmental policies. And in the last year, there have been several. We've seen proposed standards for so-called forever chemicals known as PFAS come before the board. We saw the contentious wolf debate come before the board as far as a wolf harvest quota for last fall's wolf hunt, which was eventually put on hold. But, you know, these are issues that Dr. Fred Prehn has said was part of the reason that he wanted to remain on the Natural Resources Board, is because of these important issues regarding wildlife and water. And in his time serving on the board, he's kind of played a deciding, he's been a deciding vote. Especially with the wolf harvest quota last fall. You know, initially that vote came down 5-2, I believe, but Sharon Adams, another board member, said later that she was confused. So really it was a conservative majority of that board that decided they were going to set a harvest level of 300 wolves for the fall hunt, which went way above and beyond what the DNR had recommended, and is way beyond what environmental groups and wildlife advocacy groups wanted. And then when you saw the PFAS standards issue come up, you know, the board outright voted to reject groundwater standards that were recommended by the DNR and state health officials, and they weakened the PFAS standard for drinking water in Wisconsin. And now we've seen the US EPA under President Joe Biden come out with even more restrictive health advisory levels for these chemicals. So basically saying that whatever was in place before is not enough to protect public health. And that's what the board decided to go with as the threshold for the drinking water standards. So people are really upset about him remaining on the board, but there's also a lot of people who think that he should be there deciding these issues, especially among conservatives and business lobbyists and Republican lawmakers.
In your reporting on this, you focus on the Natural Resources Board. Is there concern that there are other unconfirmed appointees who could face similar situations or be ousted if there's a change of administration?
Yeah, I believe that Attorney General Josh Call told the Associated Press the other day that this sets a terrible precedent, that this would in fact have the effect of basically the Senate could just hold off on confirming any nomination that the Evers administration may have and just wait and hope that they get a Republican governor in office with the election this fall. So there's no incentive right now for the parties to work with each other. It's kind of this back and forth. And I think it's really the voters of the state who lose on this one. No matter what political party you're from, neither the administration nor Republicans are working together on this. And we should be able to have a system that works and functions regardless of whoever has political power at the moment.
And getting back to the Natural Resources Board in particular, it sounds like this is a done deal. The highest court in the state has ruled on this. So is there still any thought that this might change?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, this will probably come up on a case by case basis. You know, we might see it soonest with the UW Board of Regents. I believe Rebecca Clayfish and Kevin Nicholson, who are running for governor as Republicans on the ballot this fall, they have said that they would eliminate any Evers appointees and install their own political appointees to that board that's more in line with their goals for higher education. And it could come up with a number of other positions.
We'll leave it there. Danny, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. We talked with her about why Natural Resources Board member Fred Prehn is still serving on the board despite his term expiring over a year ago and what it can mean for environmental policy here in the state. Coming up, we talk with the leader of a conservative Wisconsin law firm about the legal landscape for abortion seekers and providers in the state following the overturning of Roe v. Wade by the U.S. Supreme Court last week. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We heard last week that abortion appointments in Wisconsin immediately halted following the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. 4 days later, Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call announced a lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's 1849 law banning most abortions in the state. We talked to the Attorney General here on Central Time after that announcement. Our next guest says that suit should be immediately dismissed. Rick Essenberg is President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Before we get to the lawsuit, Rick, I just wanted to get your general reaction to last Friday's big news from the U.S. Supreme Court on Roe v. Wade.
Well, you know, I wrote my law review note on Roe versus Wade back when Jimmy Carter was president. And the problem with Roe has been since the beginning that no matter what you feel about abortion rights, it's very difficult to justify the decision legally. You know, one of the great legal scholars, liberal legal scholars, really, of the time said that The problem with Roe is not that it's bad constitutional law, but it doesn't even attempt to be constitutional law. It's really more an exercise in philosophy. And so I think for 49 years, people have tried to find the legal justification for Roe that the court never provided. Nobody was able to do that. And so I think what happened last Friday was inevitable once you got a textualist, originalist majority on the court.
I want to give a listen now to Attorney General Call talking to us earlier this week, shortly after he and Governor Evers announced the lawsuit.
So today we announced a lawsuit arguing that the 19th century abortion ban is not in effect in Wisconsin, and that first, it's inconsistent with laws that were passed more recently that regulate abortion but don't prohibit it. And when there are inconsistent laws, there's a lot of court precedent for the idea that the more recently passed laws control. And then we've also argued that the disuse of the abortion ban, which has been understood to be unconstitutional for more than 50 years and was only sporadically used even before then, renders it unenforceable as well.
So we'll unpack bits and pieces of that. But big picture, Rick, as you see it, is there an abortion ban in effect in Wisconsin today?
Yes, I think there is. I think that the law, which Attorney General Call is challenging, was one of the first laws passed by the state of Wisconsin. It was passed as part of the codification of laws treating homicide right after we became a state. It has been amended a number of times over the ensuing century, generally making it a little bit stricter. And then during the period that Roe was pending, although, as Attorney General Call points out, the legislature did from time to time pass laws regulating abortion, it pointedly did not repeal this old law prohibiting abortion, reflecting a clear legislative intent that that law remain on the books until such time as Roe may be overturned.
Did those laws, those later laws, specifically say that? I mean, some states have structured laws saying, you know, if and when Roe is overturned, that triggers or sunsets this law in the past. Is that in the text of those later laws?
Well, it wasn't a trigger law in the sense that a trigger law is a very different thing. It's a law in which a state that did not have a prohibition on of abortion on the books would pass a law knowing that it couldn't be enforced, but would provide that it would come into effect within, it's usually about 30 days, some period of time after Roe versus Wade is overturned. Here we had a law preceding Roe, still on the books, not enforceable because of Roe, but the legislature, despite having 49 years to repeal that law, oftentimes having a Democratic majority in both houses of the legislature and a Democratic governor, chose not to do so. And so, you know, Attorney General Call here is arguing for what is called implied repeal. That is, he wants to argue that the old law was repealed even though the legislature never actually did it. The problem with his theory, and he's got a bigger procedural problem with his case before we even get to the substance of his theory. The problem with that theory is that courts tell us that implied repeal is strongly disfavored. It can work only in the rarest of circumstances, and it ultimately is a matter of legislative intent. But the legislature here clearly never intended to repeal the law because it pointedly did not do it. It simply passed a series of regulations that enacted those restrictions on abortion, which could be enacted while Roe was in effect. But the legislature quite clearly declined to repeal the law that Attorney General Call is now challenging.
But before moving on from that point, Attorney General Call again argued you have two laws on the books. One says abortion is illegal except in very limited circumstances. One says it's legal in a wider variety of circumstances. Isn't it worth at least the legislature going back and clarifying?
Well, one might want to have the legislature go back and clarify. One might say, for example, that the legislature should restate the old law to, you know, say, provide an exception, you know, for rape and incest. That's all a legislative determination. That's for the legislature to do. That's not for the courts. It's not for Attorney General Call. But it's not that unusual that there would be conduct that would be simultaneously prohibited by a number of different statutes. There are inconsistent, or not inconsistent, there are multiple criminal prohibitions of the same conduct. And as long as they're not used in ways that violate the due process clause, they don't present a legal problem. Again, the matter is one of legislative intent. Did the legislature intend to repeal this earlier law? Quite clearly, they didn't. What they intended to do is enact whatever restrictions they could enact while Roe is in place.
Talking to Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, looking at post Roe v. Wade Wisconsin and the lawsuit from the state's attorney general against an 1849 law, or intended to stop the implementation of an 1849 law against abortion. So we're going to call her. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I do find it kind of funny that the host would talk about, you know, and I've heard this a lot from people on the left, that, you know, this law is so old. It's 150 years old, and we should not enforce it. Yet at the same time, they'll say, well, Roe has been on the books now for 50 years, so we have to support it. So it's kind of funny that at one hand, they'll say this law is too old, so we can't enforce it. But this other law is 50 years old. It's very old. We have to support that one. I just find that inconsistency in the argument pretty funny.
Steve, thanks for the call. I didn't say that the law was too old to enforce, just to clarify. But Rick, what do you make of Steve's point?
Well, I think Steve is making an excellent point about Attorney General Call's second theory of the case, and that is that we simply have to ignore the law because it hasn't been enforced in so long. Well, that's a little bit like, you know, an orphan, you know, who, you know, somebody who, you know, kills their parents and then asks for the mercy of the court because they're an orphan. The reason that the law hasn't been enforced is because of a federal judicial decision which has now been overturned, Roe versus Wade. And so, you know, that tells us absolutely nothing. And I'm aware of no case law that supports the notion that because there was a statute that was in place for a long time but unenforceable because of a Supreme Court decision, that we can now ignore it once the Supreme Court has told us that that older decision was an error and has been reversed.
Thanks for the call, Steve. I want to talk about enforcement of the 1849 law, assuming that ends up being and staying in effect. It has the exemption to save the life of the mother. Some Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, wants to add maybe some more exceptions. A couple pro-life groups want to tighten up the life of the mother exception. How do you see that being enforced under the law as it stands?
Well, I mean, the statute provides that abortion is prohibited except to save the life of the mother as certified by, you know, two physicians. So, you know, that strikes me as language that, you know, certainly is capable of administration and enforcement. I do think that there's a larger question now that Roe has been overturned, and the question of abortion regulation has now been returned to the states. And I think that what the Dobbs decision challenges us to do is to have a rational and deliberate debate, one in which we try to refrain from calling each other names or using barnyard epithets like the governor did, and say, okay, look, what do we want the law regulating abortion to look like? And it may well be, as Speaker Voss suggests, that we want a rape and incest exception, which is not in the law today. It may be that there are other things that we might be able to reach some consensus on. But what we're faced with now is a situation where, you know, the legislature and the governor are going to have to do their jobs. They're not going to be able to posture. They're not going to be able to blame somebody else. The decision has returned to them, and it is incumbent upon them now to engage in a conversation and a debate, which Roe has basically prohibited for almost 50 years, and decide exactly what the regulation of abortion in Wisconsin should look like.
One big change, of course, from 1849 until now is medication-related abortions. How do you see that fitting into the enforcement of that law, again, assuming it stays on the books?
Well, you know, it becomes a quite complicated question because, you know, I think Speaker Voss in his comments referred to Plan B or the morning after pill. As I understand the science of the matter, and, you know, as a doctor, I'm a really good lawyer, so I may have this wrong, but it's not clear that Plan B is actually an abortifacient. If it's not an abortifacient, it doesn't destroy the life of an unborn child, it wouldn't be prohibited by, you know, Section 940.04, which is the law that was enacted at the time of statehood and has been on the books ever since. There are other drugs that clearly are abortifacients that would be prohibited by the law, but then there would come into play all of these, you know, complicated questions about, well, what happens if you get this these drugs prescribed by going out of state? What happens if you take them out of state? Does that violate the laws of the state of Wisconsin? Presumably it doesn't. There are going to be all these ancillary questions that, you know, law enforcement authorities and the courts are going to have to wrestle with as we go forward, and which I suppose is another reason why, you know, a restatement of law might be in order.
Rick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
That's Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We talked to him today about his legal view on Wisconsin's legal landscape for abortion following the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade a week ago. We also got his response to a lawsuit filed earlier this week by the Wisconsin Department of Justice challenging the state's 1849 law banning most abortions. We heard from the attorney general about that lawsuit earlier this week. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, bald eagles are nesting in all of Wisconsin's 72 counties. We'll find out how a long-term recovery effort has brought them back and hear why they have a special meaning here in the state. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, when's the last time you visited your local shopping mall? We'll talk to a design critic about the life and possible death and maybe rebirth of shopping malls. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, a chef talks to us about seasonal eating, how we can get started, and some of the great things we can cook with now and in the months to come. First, the shopping mall started off as a uniquely American institution. You might have spent some of your childhood there. Cue a 1980s mall commercial.
Bayshore Mall has something special in your mailbox. Four 20% off coupons that you can redeem at any participating store Thursday through Sunday. The beach goes on with savings, fashion, food, and fun. Catch the beach,
it's a mall commercial from back in 1988, in some ways the heyday of shopping malls. But malls faded in popularity over the years. There were too many of them. Big box stores added competition. Then internet shopping and the pandemic came along. But hold on, our next guest says malls aren't dead. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you spend a lot of time in malls maybe during your childhood? Do you shop in them a lot in your adulthood? Do you have a story about a memorable time you had shopping or working at a mall? Is there a future for them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra Lang is a design critic. Her writing's been published in places including Harvard Design Magazine, The New York Times, and The Atlantic. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. Alexandra, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I love that ad.
Now, you and I are roughly the same age. I won't reveal it to people, but I was a kid. I was a teenager in an era where going to the mall was just a thing you would do, not to buy anything necessarily. It was an attraction, and that was part of your growing up too.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up in North Carolina, and what did you do when you wanted to meet your friends on a weekend afternoon? You went to the mall. Like, maybe you went to the movies, maybe you went to the food court, maybe you just walked around and looked at things. But that was the place to go. And I think that was true for basically millions of kids, especially those who grew up in the 80s and 90s.
Now, your book isn't just a trip through nostalgia, though. What led you to decide to study malls from a design critic standpoint?
Well, I had read a lot of the stories about the death of the mall, but at the same time, I read other stories talking about, pretty famous architects like Renzo Piano designing new retail structures that seemed to me to be a mall. They weren't calling them malls, but they were definitely malls. And I wanted to delve into the history of shopping centers and malls and figure out why they were so popular and what was still good about them.
Now, there's one key figure, an immigrant design person responsible for the mall in its modern form, Victor Gruen. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right. Can you tell us a bit about his role in the creation of what we think of as the mall?
Sure. It's Victor Gruen. That's right. He is really the father of the shopping mall. He was a Jewish emigre from Vienna. He fled the Nazis in 1938 and came to America. And he was somebody who started designing department stores and quickly realized that the new suburbs needed a place for people to go. They needed a new downtown. And the way that they were being built, there was no main street. And he thought, what if we can get the department store owners to move from downtown to these suburban areas and build a whole main street around their store? And the first shopping mall was built in Edina, Minnesota in 1956, and that's Southdale. And it basically has this central court that has climate control, it has daylighting, and it has a little Viennese-style cafe off to the side because he thought that's what Americans needed.
The idea was that, hey, this is in some ways a public space, but protected from the weather, accessible to people in this area. Talk about Victor Gruen's vision for what he hoped the mall would be.
Yeah, I mean, Southdale, some of the initial advertising trumpeted the fact that there would be 365 shopping days a year, because you know this in Wisconsin too. In the winter, nobody wants to go shopping outdoors. So the mall provided indoor year-round shopping, and it was also supposed to serve as kind of a community gathering space. Those initial malls especially often had sculpture, they had a carousel for the kids, they had cafes, and they basically had stores that would serve all of the needs of what was often the mother living in the suburbs who had to do a bunch of errands with kids tagging along. But he also felt like they should have a public role. Some of those early malls had community rooms or churches, and people, in his view, just needed a place to come together.
You write that part of the appeal of malls in these suburban areas was it was a place where you wouldn't run into poor people on the streets. You wouldn't worry about the crime, say, in a downtown area. And in many suburbs with restrictive zoning laws, you wouldn't run into black people at a mall. This was not all a happy thing in some ways.
Right. That is definitely true. Malls are in some ways a manifestation of white flight from central cities. And many of the neighborhoods around the malls would have restrictions on who could buy the housing. So even if the malls weren't specifically designated as a white space, they would have been a white space because only white people lived around them. And because they are, in fact, private property, they could be regulated, maintained, et cetera, to kind of a higher standard and a more restricted standard than you would get in downtowns, which are actually public space.
Talking to Alexandra Lang about her new book, Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have fond or less than fond memories of spending time at a mall? Did you go to them a lot in their heyday? Do you still go to your local community shopping mall? If not, what replaced it to meet your shopping needs? Do you miss anything about having a place with big fountain in it and all the mall-like amenities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra, malls were super successful, right, for a long time. Can you talk about malls at their peak?
Malls at their peak, they were building basically hundreds of malls per year because every suburb needed one. And during the time when they were at their peak, people did a lot of really kind of fun and innovative things with them. I think the innovation that most people are familiar with is the Mall of America, which put an entire roller coaster in the center of the mall, you know, no fountain, but a roller coaster. So there was this sense that malls had to kind of top themselves and that they were also competing in the fashion marketplace for the newer, better, you know, kind of more technologically advanced mall. And that's a really fun period to study, basically, you know, leading through the 80s and into the early 90s.
I listed a few causes of a decline for malls, and we've seen that in a lot of places around the country. One was, you write, they just built a lot of malls, maybe too many malls. How did we end up with a glut?
Well, the short answer to that is capitalism. Basically, mall developers saw where a mall had been successful but was maybe getting a little tired looking and just built a new mall 10 miles away in a fresher suburb and sucked all of the business from that older mall to the newer mall rather than building one in a place that hadn't had a mall. So then you get two malls, one's doing well, one's on a slow decline, and may eventually die. So I think that over competition and kind of lack of imagination and where to open new malls really doomed a lot of them.
Talking to Alexandra Lang, design critic. Her new book is Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. We're looking at malls past, present, and future. And yes, she says there is a future. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is in store for the future of American shopping malls? Maybe they look different now, laid out differently. We'll get into that in just a bit. Are you now or have you ever been a mall shopper, or have you worked at malls? Do you have an experience you would like to share? Do you have a question about how they've changed over the years? And hey, do you have a mall that is unused or disused in your community? What would you like to see happen to it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about shopping malls, their history, their design, their future. Alexandra Lang is with us, design critic. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you go to malls in your heyday? Did you make plans to meet someone by the fountain or the food court or you name it? Are malls part of the distant past for you or part of the present in how and where you shop? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra, one key point I take away from your book is, yeah, we might keep saying malls are dead or dying. Malls are not dead, and they're not necessarily dying. Why? Make the case for us.
Well, some malls are dying, but even the most doomsday predictions by retail experts still indicate that there are probably going to be 700 to 800 healthy malls in the U.S., which still seems like a heck of a to me. Those malls tend to be like newer malls, malls with higher-end department stores, and those have really held on to their customer base and are still offering something that people want. I think the dead mall narrative was really spurred by a lot of actually often very beautiful photography of dead malls that went viral, and people just kind of extrapolated from that and were like, okay, malls are over.
We heard from Ravana on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who says they always hated the mall, but sometimes when they went to their local one, there was a survey company in it. Ravana learned to spot the surveyors to participate in surveys, be sure to walk by them so they could take a survey and get cash or coupons for the food court. Says made having to be in the mall a little better. I did a soda challenge at a mall one time. I intentionally picked the wrong one and I didn't get the free soda. I was just being ornery. But Alexandra, you know, that reminds me, like, the question of whether a mall is a public space. A survey company might set up shop there. Can protesters set up shop at a mall? Is this really a public sphere we can go into and interact with people? Has been a question over the years.
It has. And that the answer to that question actually varies state by state. The first legal case around whether a mall was public space and could be used for public protest actually occurred in 1968. And Thurgood Marshall wrote the opinion, the majority opinion, and said that malls should be available for protest because they were becoming the new main street. Now, over the years, that right has been whittled away, and now it really depends where you're located, whether or not you can protest at the mall.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. KB is with us in La Crosse. KB, hello.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
What'd you want to tell us about?
Hey, I just wanted to mention I, in a previous life, worked in Rosedale Mall up in Roseville, Minnesota, and it was a blast. I actually loved that job because of the network of other employees and other shops. It got to the point where we'd all make friends with each other and stuff and offer each other our employee discounts, kind of like a whole barter system kind of thing. You know, I worked in a record shop and CDs and video games and stuff, and, you know, there'd be the girl down the hall who worked in a hair salon, and she'd do my hair, and I'd give her my employee discount for her CD that she wanted, you know, so David Bowie specifically, you know, kind of thing. You know, it's kind of cool.
KB, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. I worked in a mall for some years, and I got pretty good deals on some Sbarro's breadsticks, not going to lie. Alexander, the people who work at malls, a community, KB says. I don't know if you'd looked at the mall workers that much, but it's a unique kind of place to work.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories like that, often from people that were hanging out at malls anyway as teens and then thought, hey, I should get a job here too. But I think that's a great kind of tribute to the fact that the mall can be a community space. Yes, we tend to focus more on the consumers, but having all of those businesses in proximity is part of what makes malls great. And the workers are really just taking advantage of the same kind of proximities as customers are.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Alexandra Lang. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Alexander, maybe my favorite chapter was your last one. I think of malls as American, and not so much anymore. You surveyed some malls around the world, and they're kind of taking us to mall school.
They are. One of my favorite examples in that chapter is from the Philippines, where the malls are all basically the same size as the Mall of America. And they are very often on light rail lines. They will have government offices in them. They're basically like satellite cities all under one roof. And I think, especially if we're going to try to densify cities and inner ring suburbs, thinking of the mall as something that can truly be an urban hub is a great way to go. But it would require us sort of like opening our eyes to what's happening elsewhere in the world with malls.
And one interesting bit of motivation, I think it was Chile, you gave an example where if I own a mall, I can get a pretty good tax break if I host a museum or a library or other public institution.
Exactly. That is true in Chile. And actually, it's also true in the U.S. I got a message from a public library in Maryland that is located in the mall. They started as just a kind of like check in, check out mini branch, and the mall said, oh, you're doing so well, like, let's give you 30,000 square feet. And now it's one of the most popular branches in the county.
I want to look at some of the ways malls or the spaces they are on are changing. I've seen a lot of malls around the state here go from the all indoor enclosed to doing some redesign and, you know, having an outdoor street and you enter the buildings from outside. So outdoorizing these indoor malls. Is that a trend everywhere in the country?
That is a trend everywhere in the country. It's generally, you know, more popular in the South and in California, where the weather is nicer year-round. But that is definitely a trend. I also think, you know, something that's really important is there's been the demise of a lot of department stores. And so as malls try to reposition themselves, coming up with other uses for those department store spaces, things that people really do want to leave their house for, is super important. And some of the most important things in those categories that I've seen are food, you know, food halls, food marketplaces, and also kind of family fun like trampoline parks.
And another change that seems to be going on, well, grocery stores are part of malls more and more now, you write, but also malls, including on their grounds, residential stuff, maybe upstairs or maybe on the outskirts.
Yeah, a lot of people are suddenly realizing that malls have way too much parking. And what can we do with especially the parking lots around the edges of the malls where maybe we want to start making nicer, more pedestrian streets? And those are really ripe for building housing, especially kind of townhouses, low-rise apartment buildings in places that really need to build more residential.
We heard from Charlie in Eau Claire, who couldn't stay on the line. Charlie grew up in the 70s. She says the name of the book is fantastic. Threw her right back into her childhood. Charlie remembers going to Hot Sam's and Orange Julius to eat with friends. Yeah, when you started thinking, should I write a book about malls? People were very quick to share their mall memories with you, right?
Yeah, and as an architecture critic, like, I want to write about things, buildings, designs that people have feelings about. And so malls just felt like this great untapped resource that, oh, people love this architecture, even if they've never thought about it as architecture.
You mentioned untapped resources, and you write about malls that are more or less completely defunct, actually being potentially great opportunities to use that land, but in different ways. What kind of things are you seeing?
Well, one of my favorite examples is Austin Community College, their Highland campus in Texas, where an entire community college moved into a defunct mall, and they have built new residential housing in the parking lots, and they actually now have enough space so that they've invited the local public TV station to have their offices, you know, in one of the former department stores. And so it's becoming this whole mixed-use community and a center for students when before it was just this big dead mall.
What are you watching for? Now I mentioned the glut of malls. There's also big box stores challenging them, internet shopping, the pandemic, and more. What are some of the big trends you're watching for now in 2022 when it comes to the malls you've been researching for so long?
I think the major trend is that kind of mixed use redevelopment, saying, okay, like we still want to have retail here. People, you know where it is, know what to shop for here. But what else can we do with the parking lot? What other kinds of things can we invite into this space, whether those are medical facilities or churches or kind of the upscale supermarkets that you can eat in, that will really bring people out of their houses and allow them to kind of get together in an air-conditioned space, a space with a fountain, a space maybe with indoor plants.
And one thing that struck me, it seems like nowadays mall, for people who are building malls, maybe a four-letter word. It seems like some of the people you want to talk to want to call their thing anything but mall.
That is so true. Let's see, what did they try to tell me? They called it a vertical retail center. They called it like a piazza. They called it a marketplace. But I just felt like people know what a mall is. Like when I say mall, you know what I'm talking about. And if I say vertical retail center, it's like, what?
Alexandra, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Alexandra Lang is a design critic. She joins us today for a look at her new book. It's called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. Still time for you to share your mall memories, if any, whether they go back 3 decades or 3 minutes. Let us know what you think about malls, past, present, and future. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And hey, if you have a building that we would typically have called a mall in years past that's getting used differently now, where some of the space is getting used in a different way than straight up retail, love to hear about that too. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, what fresh summer vegetables do you look forward to the most? A chef talks to us about seasonal eating, what it means, why we might want to give it a try. And you can join us and tell us your favorite things to eat in a Wisconsin summer. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.